Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins as my great producers. A reminder that we are Zooming this show on Thursday morning. So if something should happen Thursday night, we'll be discussing it on Monday. As you've come to expect, we will be doing this until November 3rd, Election Day. We begin this show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I believe that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has just come out with a new book entitled Right Matters. I recommend that you grab that book and support him because he was a patriot, he spoke truth to power, and he suffered the consequences as a result. All right, now everyone, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, and our go-to guy when it comes to politics and history and economics and sort of, you're just the best teacher about
Texas.
Oh,
Arnie, stop.
No, you are. You are. I actually get notes from people who say, I missed Friday's show. I missed Friday's show. What did Scott say? You know, so they really feel like even if they're living in Iowa, even if they're living in Michigan, they have a connection to you because you've made us understand why Texas is so important to the not only presidential campaign, but to sort of the national landscape going forward. As we begin this show, Stephanie Collins, my producer, said,
oh, yeah.
What's that poster behind you, Scott Braddock?
Right.
Now, remember, we're Zooming. So
we're Zooming, so she can see into my little home office here, and there's this flag behind me. It's the Gonzales flag, which I am sure in New Hampshire you have no idea what that means, but it's the Texas equivalent of Live Free or Die. It was October, it's actually this month, in 1835, October 2nd, 1835. Okay. The Battle of Gonzales was one of the engagements between the Texians and the Mexican army. There was a detachment of Mexican soldiers in the area of what is now the town and county of Gonzales, which is in South Texas. All they really had to defend themselves with, the Texians, I keep using that term, they had not much to defend themselves except they had one small cannon. They were ready to take on the Mexican army, and so it was very crudely drawn. The flag you see behind me is sort of the updated version that everybody kind of knows now in Texas. You see the flag, there's a star over the cannon, and underneath it are the words, come and take it, which is what the Texians drew on their flag. They put up this flag, come take our cannon, and that's sort of the spirit of Texas from then on, come and take it. So, of course, they had that battle. It was the Battle at the Alamo. It was the Battle at San Jacinto. Of course, they were eventually successful against the Mexican army, but it was a bunch of little scrappers taking on, you know, this tyrannical government in Mexico. And of course, there's all kinds of controversy back and forth about that, but it's a part of our rich history. But it's the one that people around here, that's the one you would hang up.
And I want people to understand that in a lot of ways, I'm really glad you sort of shared that little bit of history with us. I feel like on Tuesday, on the election day, people are overwhelmed by the money and the opposition and people walking around with guns and people not wearing masks. And I'm reminding people, you have a weapon, and your weapon is your vote. And if you don't exercise the vote, you don't find your power, and you don't use your power. And one of the reasons why people want to suppress the vote, they are afraid of you. So you know what? Make sure they know why they're afraid, because you go and you vote. And when I say that, I'm looking at the incredible turnout in Texas. Blow me away. It continues, Scott. How do you sort of looking through the sort of tea leaves, the political tea leaves, what do you think that is saying about a state that is notorious because people don't vote in Texas. It's a no vote state, not even a red state. And yet this seems to be changing, especially this election cycle.
Such a BS line that people say all the time. They say it's not a red state. Let me fix that for everybody. Okay. It's a red state because it's a no voting state.
Right. Okay.
Right. Beto O'Rourke says this all the time. It's not a red state. It's a non-voting state. It's a red state because people don't vote. Right. And I keep repeating this.
Beautiful.
Over and over for people. You've got to connect the dots, Arnie, right? What I'm about to say is true until it's not. And this election could prove it untrue. We'll see. We'll all stay tuned, for next Tuesday. There are more Republican voters in Texas than there are Democratic voters. There may be more Democrats in Texas than Republicans, but it does not matter if they don't vote, right? So we look across the landscape now. We're closing in on about 8 million people who have voted early so far over this expanded early voting period, in sort of threading the needle and trying to figure out how to not make the Democrats too angry and not make the Republicans too angry. He has this way of middling himself. Usually it means that when you try to make everybody happy, that nobody likes you. But what he decided to do, instead of expanding mail ballots, which is what Democrats wanted to do, but Republicans very upset about that and don't want to do that and have been in court all over the country about that. Instead, the governor said, we'll have 3 weeks of early voting in person instead of 2 weeks, which is what we normally get in Texas. I was wondering what's going to happen here. I had a sense that the voting would be pretty front-loaded, that people have basically made up their minds about this, not just for months. People are ready to either vote for President Trump or get rid of President Trump, right? There's not much in between. I want to go watch one of these presidential debates with some people in an environment like this who are not decided and see what their attitude is like. People were waking up at 4 a.m. on the very first day of early voting a couple weeks ago to go be able to do it. On the day that our show airs here, Arnie, it's the last day of early voting. Kamala Harris will be in Houston and down in McAllen in South Texas and in a couple other places before she heads on. It's fascinating to see the VP nominee for the Democratic Party campaigning in Texas just a few days before the general election. We're not used to that kind of attention in this state. But look, when you take a look at where the votes have come from, you take a look at the primary histories of people who have been voting in these elections so far. And I was looking through some of the numbers, give some of them to you here. There's a really fascinating report that comes out each day from a friend of mine named Derek Ryan, who is the former data guru for the Republican Party of Texas. And he goes through the numbers with a fine-tooth comb. And he is a Republican, but he's pretty well respected by Republicans and Democrats alike for just slicing and dicing the numbers. Right. I mean, he can't put out public numbers. He does the math. There are, Arnie, 3.5, and this was his report last night. There are 3.5 million people who have voted early who have not voted in a primary election ever. Okay, wow. So we don't know exactly what they're going to do. If you look out across the state, it's about right that almost everywhere in Houston and DFW and the Austin area where I am and down in San Antonio, Bexar County, is about 10% of people who have never voted before. So we're getting some brand new people, and who knows which way they're going to swing. In some of the suburban counties, I might have mentioned this last week. I got the number late in the week, but it just sort of makes your eyes pop out of your head. In Collin County, which is one of the Dallas suburbs just north of Dallas, it's where Toyota put its North American headquarters a couple of years ago. And so they've had all of these people moving in to that area. Our suburbs are just growing rapidly, and you don't see any sign of that slowing down, even in the pandemic. 1,000 people still move to Texas every day. In Collin County, 26% of people have never voted before, ever, not in a primary, not in a general election. What do you think those people are going to do? And we have some Republican representatives from that area, including members of Congress, members of the Texas legislature, who are really sweating it there in that area. But the same thing in Fort Bend County, which is just to the southwest of Houston, same thing in Williamson County and Hays County. Hays County, I believe, has surpassed its complete voter numbers from 2016 already during early vote. So it was the case that you had a bunch of people in the first couple of days of early voting, and I thought it might taper off a little bit. It has, sort of, but in Harris County, which is home to 1/5 of the Texas electorate, each day, and I think I texted you this, Arnie, they had already surpassed 1 million votes in Harris County, and they were voting at about 100,000 people voting strength every single day. If you go and look at what has happened with the exponential growth of people not just being in Texas, people participating in the process in Texas, let's go back to 2014. I've done this lesson a few times, but let's do it again. It's cliche to say that elections have consequences, but it's true, right? In 2014, which is two midterms ago, 2014, about 4 million people voted in Texas, and the governor, Greg Abbott, beat Wendy Davis, the former state senator, by 21 points in 2014. Fast forward to 2018, when double that number, 8.4 million people voted in 2018, which is on par with the presidential election in previous cycles in Texas. We would see probably anywhere from 8 to 9 million people voting, something like that, in 2016. Look at what happened in those legislative sessions. 2017, before that giant spike in voter turnout in Texas, in 2017, what was the state government focused on? It was focused on who could go to what bathroom. We argued about that a lot down here. Remember that? It was focused on cracking down on undocumented immigrants with the Senate Bill 4 that you remember talking about. It was focused on a constitutional convention to rewrite the United States Constitution, supporting that. A bunch of red meat, right-wing stuff. That's in 2017. In 2018, 8.4 million people vote, and Ted Cruz almost loses his U.S. Senate seat. And Republicans up and down the ballot were losing their races. There were 12 new, when the dust settled from all that, there were 12 new Democrats in the Texas House of Representatives. There were two new Democrats in the Texas Senate, and two congressional seats in Texas had been flipped in Dallas County and in Harris County. That's Colin Allred and Lizzie Fletcher, who beat Republicans in 2018. So what do you know? In 2017, crazy dumpster fire right-wing legislative session. Then you have this election in which a bunch of Republicans lose. And in 2019's legislative session, what was the focus? Just property taxes and school finance and nothing else. They didn't want to talk about anything else. Now we're moving into 2020. What does that exponential growth in participation in elections mean for 2020? Well, if we look at the early vote so far, and we look at the fact that something like 4.55 million people who have voted, previously I mentioned people who had never voted before, at least 5 million people or so have voted pretty regularly in the last couple of cycles and still haven't voted this year. So that probably means that we're on track to have 12 or 13 million people vote in this state this year, which is incredible, and it may have some serious consequences for who gets to stay in office and who doesn't. I mean, if you look at what's going on with the U.S. Senate race right now, it has turned really nasty here in the last few days. It must be getting close to Election Day with basically MJ Hager, the Democrat, accusing John Cornyn of being a spineless bastard in her latest television ad. I'll send you that. She says it's not the corrupting forces. I'm paraphrasing, but she says it's not the corrupting forces of Washington that are so terrible. It's the people who go there and sell us out to them. You know, that's her sort of thing. And right. And just yes,
That's brutal.
It's pretty brutal. And yeah, just yesterday, Cornyn was on a bus tour. I have the pictures of this on my Twitter feed. Cornyn on a bus tour with the all-star cast with former Governor Perry, who I got to tell you, Arnie, now that he's not in the Trump administration anymore, I think that his blank factor has really gone down. He's not even combing his hair anymore. He was getting on the bus just wearing like a sweatshirt, pointing at the crowd, the double point at the crowd. Anyway, they did a press conference in Houston with Governor Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Patrick, the retiring the Speaker of the House, Dennis Bonin, and John Cornyn. They were talking about this need to defend the police and not defund the police. You know, this is the big push by the Republicans to try to scare people about getting rid of the cops. I don't know if it's resonating. They must have something that they're seeing in their poll numbers to suggest that this is still a good argument to make, particularly to people in the suburbs, which I can see that. But this is something that was really top of mind for people during the middle of the summer in the wake of the death of George Floyd and the riots and the protests that were happening, mostly peaceful protests. But of course, there were some problems. And of course, you had Joe Biden and Barack Obama both say people need to keep it peaceful out there if they're going to be protesting. That was, you know, in the last few months. I don't know if people even care about that anymore. And I mean, we'll see. I mean, we'll see what the result is. But at that press conference, John Cornyn was attacking Hager as being somebody who wants to defund the police, really making this, I guess, the closing argument for the campaign, because we still have some people yet to vote. But you have to believe that most of the result is probably baked in at this point, and it's kind of late to be making these arguments. With that really negative television ad that Hager is running, you know, you would maybe think that for her, they're either seeing something, and you've seen this in campaigns a million times, they're either seeing something in their polling that indicates that, wow, we've got him on the ropes and we can really go in for the kill now if we really do this, you know, negative attack, or they're seeing something in the polling that suggests the other attacks haven't really worked, so they have to amp it all up. You find out which of those is right after the election.
Given what I'm seeing with the pandemic and the spikes and what we're hearing about with hospitals, especially, I think it was in El Paso, and we know that Texas has the highest percentage of uninsured in America. I can't imagine that they're ignoring the pandemic, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, I just saw that the price of oil has dropped below $40 a barrel, in part because they've been so battered by the hurricanes. So obviously weather is a consequence, and that has to affect Texas. And then the last thing is on the defund the police. Has MJ Hager said, well, you know who's really defunding the police? Donald Trump and the Republicans, because they didn't give us a second bailout where money would be coming to state and local government so we could pay the police, so we could pay the teachers, so we could pay the EMTs. So if you want to know who's defunding the police, let me put a Republican name in front of it, because that's who's doing it. So therefore, castrating them on a message that seems a little outdated anyway, but also focusing on the fact that the real problem right now is what's happening with the hurricanes as it's affecting the oil and gas industry, and what's happening with the pandemic, which is obviously devastating the economy and our hospitals.
You know, we have an uptick in crime in Austin, and you heard Senator Cornyn and Governor Abbott yesterday talking about the idea that the Austin police have been defunded, that Austin City Hall cut their budget by a third, which is not quite right. There was some diversion of funds, but you get it. There was not the most truthful representation of what's happened at Austin City Hall. And we do have this uptick in crime. But what I would say about that is you have to look at it. It's a larger picture. It's not like the people in Austin who have been committing some of these crimes were reading the Austin American-Statesman or watching KXAN television newscast and saying, oh, look, they cut the police at Austin City Hall, I'm going to go on a crime spree. That's not what happened. That's ridiculous. That's not what happened. Now, I could see making the argument that it's not the right time to maybe move funds from the police department. To your point, the folks in Washington have not backed up the state and local governments about any of their needs, really, after that first round of stimulus. And there is the fact that the Republican president has overseen a great recession. So, of course, you have seen crime go up. That always goes up. When you have hardship economically and you have racial strife in the streets, what do you think is going to happen? These are the people who are overseeing it. I mean, if you look at the numbers that are coming out about the economy this morning, Arnie, it makes it look like, oh, wow, the American economy is just roaring back. But the numbers are, I would say they're not artificially inflated, but they look a little skewed because the economy wasn't just coming up off the mat. It was coming out from under the mat. That's how bad the economy was for the first two quarters. And so trying to climb out of that now, which we are, and hopefully it will continue to get better. But that's why we have a spike in crime. That's why we have these other issues. And to argue that, you know, it's because Austin City Hall made some tweaks to the budget is really disingenuous.
We know that Michael Bloomberg is dropping an additional $15 million to help Biden in Texas. We know that the business community is coming in for the GOP in Texas. But then you mentioned something else. You said that the polls just recently are now showing President Trump leading in Texas in the final week of the election. Explain that.
Well, we saw last week where the Quinnipiac had Biden and Trump at 47 apiece. And then over the weekend, the UT Tyler poll, which has been a pretty good poll over the years in connection with the Dallas Morning News, they had Biden up 3, which is within the margin of error. But then we had the Siena College poll, New York Times, which came out and had Biden up 6, I believe. Yes, up 6. And then you also had the University of Houston poll that had Biden, Trump was up 6, Biden down 6 in the New York Times poll. Make sure I said that right. Okay. And then in the University of Houston poll, you had Biden down 5. That Siena College poll that had Trump with a, I wouldn't say comfortable lead, but up by 6 or 7, it's a better quality poll. A lot of these polling outfits are doing the opt-in internet poll, which has all kinds of problems with it. The Siena College poll is one where they actually call people. It's a real poll, calling people and getting a real sample and, you know, figuring out exactly where they are on things and asking the real follow-up questions in real time with the skilled pollsters and all of that. It matters, you know, the way they do the poll, right? And a lot of these polls have been probably just what people wish they saw happening. I would say that going into the home stretch here, it is a tight race. I wanted to mention, I don't remember if I put this in my email to you this morning, but the lieutenant governor who reads polls better than anybody. And when you hear people say polling Texas is very difficult and it's hard to figure out what's going on there because there are not a lot of pollsters that have experience with it. Some of these good pollsters like Quinnipiac, for example, I think this is only their second election cycle to be trying to poll Texas. And so they probably are still having some difficulties. A vast, diverse electorate spread out across 254 counties and 2 time zones. You come in and you start trying to do this, it's hard. But there are good polls of Texas. They're just private polls, right? They're polls that Republican candidates paid for and they keep to themselves unless for some reason they want to share them with us. trade associations do polling that's pretty good as well here. The lieutenant governor, who polls everything from his campaign, he asks the people, you know, what they think, and then he holds up the mirror to them, you know, that to try to reflect what they want. The lieutenant governor, for months, had insisted that President Trump was going to carry Texas in better fashion than he did in 2016. President Trump beat Secretary Clinton by 9 points in Texas in 16. The lieutenant governor, going back a full year ago almost, had said that President Trump would do better in 20 than he did in 16 in Texas. But just this week, Patrick did an interview with KXAN television in Austin. A reporter, a friend of mine, John Engel, interviewed him and asked him, do you still think that's true? Looking at all these polls and looking at the backlash over the president's coronavirus response and, you know, all of the just controversy in the country, do you still think that he's going to do better in Texas than he did last time? Patrick revised his statement and said that he thought it could be as close as a 4-point race. He may have a poll that shows that. Instead of the usual swagger from Dan Patrick where he says, oh yeah, the president's going to do better than he did last time. Instead, you have the lieutenant governor now saying, oh, I'm pretty sure that he's going to win. It doesn't really matter what the margin is.
That is completely
pretty telling.
The one thing I'm curious about is talk to me a little bit about the Hispanic vote in Texas, because what I'm hearing is that Hispanic men are really trending more and more towards Donald Trump. Has Donald Trump been using that as a wedge in the Hispanic community? I'm just kind of curious because I don't get it. You look at his immigration policy, mm-hmm. You look at what's happening with the economy, you look at their opportunity, and I'm trying to figure out, is it the macho thing that they like about Donald Trump and they don't really see that with Joe Biden? Or is there really this wedge? We're seeing a bit of it in Florida. I'm kind of curious about, you know, the other state where it's an important vote, and that's Texas.
Yeah, I mean, Biden hasn't enjoyed the same kind of support from Hispanics or Latinos. Those are not interchangeable, by the way. Has not seen the same kind of support as Secretary Clinton, you know, 4 years ago. I think the Clintons, this is more institutional, they had done more work within that community to try to build that support over their years in politics, and it's not been something that Biden has been as focused on really ever. I mean, remember, what powered Biden through the primary was the overwhelming support from African-American voters to Obama-level support from voters. And so that's why Biden, when he was really starting to embrace calling himself the Obama Biden Democrat, right? What might be interesting and what a lot of folks might miss is there is a huge African-American population in Texas, particularly in Harris County and Dallas County and Deep East Texas as well. And so I think that it's going to be critical for that section of our state, you know, to really show up for Biden if he's going to be competitive here. I think that they will. That's probably why you see Kamala Harris campaigning in South Texas and in Houston, and also up in Fort Worth is the other place, the big place that she's going to be, where they do have a large African-American population as well.
And let's put Kamala's visit into perspective. I believe it's been 30 years since someone, either a president or a vice presidential candidate, has actually come to, that's not
no.
true.
Okay. No, that's right. And that's not right. Tim Kaine was here for Secretary Clinton, okay. Although somebody pointed out to me, Tim Kaine was very forgettable. So it's easy.
Oh, maybe that's why.
It's easy that people miss that, but it is true that it's been a long time since anyone of that level on a presidential campaign was in Texas this close to the election.
Okay.
That's for sure true, and that's been decades since that has happened.
All right, last but not least, really quickly, Donald Trump really thought he could go after Joe Biden on the issue of fracking. Mm-hmm. What has Joe Biden done to rehabilitate his definition of fracking and what it means to people exactly in places like Texas?
Well, you remember what Biden said in the debate last week. I think we talked about it on the on the program. Look, Biden had said that we would be transitioning away from the oil industry. Secretary Clinton also said something similar, though she didn't phrase it that way. Secretary Clinton probably talked about it the best that I've heard a Democrat at that level talk about it, which is to say that if we're going to move in a direction of getting to more reliance on solar and wind energy and green energy, you know, in a broader sense, then what we need to do is have a bridge from here to there. And the bridge from here to there would be natural gas. In Texas, we are a natural gas state. When President Trump would talk about coal all the time, he's always talking about coal. I mean, that's an argument for the people in the Rust Belt, right, in the Northeast, where they really are more reliant on coal for their economy. We're not in Texas. We have some coal, but this is a natural gas state. So if you wanted to make the case, and Biden has tried to talk about this in the meantime, he did some interviews on television stations locally. He talked to NBC's affiliate in Dallas-Fort Worth, I think on Sunday or Monday. And he talked about the idea that nobody needs to fear that we're going to move away from oil and gas, you know, instantly like that. But the reality is that for this state, it's very important for our economy. Oil and gas is for sure. But I don't know that people, when they're voting, that it's top of mind for them. And I would say we're almost out of time here, but I'll give you these numbers real fast. It's a state of 30 million people with 17 million registered voters. Direct jobs in oil and gas in Texas is about 350,000, 400,000, something like that. And all that Biden would really need to say is two things. One, a lot of the people who were laid off in oil and gas, that happened this year under President Trump. And it was this year that the price of crude went negative, but not just down, but went negative. So if Joe Biden wants to ruin the oil and gas industry, he has real competition from President Trump.
On that note, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, and the dean of the Austin Press Corps. God, the next time we talk, it'll be after the November 3rd election. I wonder what we'll be talking
about. Can you imagine?
I can't imagine. Thank you so much for joining us. Ciao. Stay safe. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio. Conversations with today's most influential authors, actors, musicians, artists, and creative minds. Just in time for Halloween, National Geographic Kids is releasing That's Creepy, spine-tingling facts that will test your creep-out factor. We caught up with Becky Baines from National Geographic to fill us in.
There was a story in the book that really, really creeped me out called The Toy of Terror. And it was about this guy who grew up in Key West, Florida, in the early 1900s, and he was given a doll by his family maid. And the story goes that the maid didn't actually really get along with the parents that well. She didn't really like them. So what she did is she put a voodoo curse on this doll and gave it to the kid. The doll's name was Robert. And the parents after that started experiencing all sorts of weird things in their house. They'd hear their son Gene in his room talking with someone who had obviously a different voice. So it wasn't Gene talking to himself, and they'd go in and it would just be him sitting there with his doll. He grew up to inherit that house from his parents, and he kept the doll that whole time. So it's this really spooky story, and they still have the doll on display in a museum in Key West, Florida. And apparently anyone who tries to take a picture of the doll without the doll's permission, without Robert's permission, their camera breaks. So it's stuff like that that's just really surprising and scary.
That's Becky Baines from National Geographic Kids on their new book, That's Creepy. There's more online. InsightDailyRadio.org.
Echoes of our future slowly fade away when I start to see you and you. left with is dust, ashes, and echoes. All that I'm left with is dust, ashes, and echoes. Ashes and
hi, welcome back to the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. If it's Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry is a former nominee for governor twice in the state of Connecticut, an advisor to Bill Clinton, worked in the nuclear freeze movement, is an incredibly articulate and progressive talker and writer. You can find his pieces on occasion at salon.com, and we are lucky enough to have him on a regular basis. So I sort of sent him a conga line of possible topics for this morning. And he kind of synthesized it down to this. What will America look like after Tuesday? Welcome to the program, Bill. And this morning, I could not get out of bed. And the reason I couldn't get out of bed was that I'm so afraid. I keep thinking, I can't lose hope. I can't lose hope. And so I kind of, in a way, I'm sort of very cathartic on my Facebook page. And I let everyone know exactly what I'm doing, how I make my bed, what's going on through my head. And what will America look like after Tuesday? And yet I think Tuesday isn't the closure we want. It's just the quote unquote end of voting. And of course, that also depends on how the Supreme Court interprets the end of voting. It leads us to both the question of what will we look like after Tuesday? And what have we become over the last 4 years? Because I think that's the other sort of bookend to what you asked.
Frank Bruni in This Morning Times talked about never being able to see America the same way again, and how whether it was our idealism or our optimism or our naivete, whatever it was, it's been overthrown by the last few years. I think the only thing I want to say first off is that it's the process, as you well know, has been going on for a lot more than 4 years. We had to become Trump to get Trump.
Yes.
We had to become a country that didn't know anything more about its history than Trump does. We had to become a country that was almost as materialistic as Trump is. We had to become a country that had cared less about the truth than it used to, almost as little as Trump does. We had to be a country of enormous insecurities and anxieties, which are just forms of fear and translated into hate and suspicion and racism, for instance. That was just everywhere. And if there were lots of years in which we couldn't see it, we seem to have arrived at a point where we can't see anything else. And so we need to guard against that too. You know, I do this thing where I ask people in giving speeches to close their eyes and imagine, and I ask them two things. One, based on all the things they've ever seen on television and the media generally, who are the American people? What are they like? And I let them do that for a few seconds. And then I ask them, if they can, to get those powerful and often negative images out of their heads and replace them with pictures of anybody they've actually met. Of all the people you meet in your own day-to-day life of whom you have firsthand experience.
Right.
And the first thing you conclude is that we don't hate each other nearly as much in real life as we do on cable television.
Absolutely.
And the second thing is that most of the people we've met strive to be open-minded, strive to be good-hearted. And so all you have to do is trust your own experience over the images filtered to us through corporate media to see a better country. Now, not a perfect country, the country with a whole lot of racism. You know, have I learned that there were more racists in America than I thought in the last 4 years? Yes, I have. Was that welcome news? Nope. I still remember what James Madison said, if you don't believe in the good-heartedness of people, you can't believe in democracy. When we lose faith in our fellow citizens, polls showing that, you know, the number of people who trust the other Americans to do the right thing has fallen in the last decade or so, a little more, from 64% who believe it to only 33%. One of the things I just want to do is sort of challenge how badly we feel about the country and about ourselves. You know, are we better than this? Isn't even the right question. The question is, can we be better than this? And that's where we go from here. I believe we can be. I believe we are, but I certainly believe we can be.
You made a statement that we sort of kind of created Donald Trump But there's been all these silos of racism, misogyny, sexism, blame, you know, corporate greed, all this stuff. And I think what Donald Trump did was that he gave all those different groups some Velcro. They now have a place to come together. He gave them an excuse to find a collective voice. That's what's so scary. Yes, they've always been there. They've never had a leader like Donald Trump who could kind of go into every one of those settings and feed their anger and feed their racism and feed their fear and feed their love of their gun. And he did it all. I mean, that's it. George Bush could not do that. Let's be honest. But Donald Trump could. Your point about who do you know versus who do you know on cable TV? That's brilliant, Bill. I think about who I know. I love the bus drivers that come across the street, that drop the kids off, that wave at me every day. I love my postman who comes and says, God, you got a whole lot of mail, Arnie. You better check that envelope. I mean, I love the cop who stops in front of my house going, anyone giving you crap, Arnie? You know what I mean? And they're from all walks of life. And even people that I disagree with, we're not really disagreeable. That's what's so amazing, is that even when we're disagreeing, we somehow manage to understand that it's not worth holding on to that anger and that angst. What cable TV has done and what social media has done has driven our lived lives out of our lives. That's what's so scary. We're living in a fairy tale that they have created, and a fairy tale that's so sordid and toxic. And yet if we actually lived in our lived lives, it would be so much better, Bill.
The first thing to understand about social media is that it is, in every sense, antisocial.
Yes.
Antisocial in the kind of behavior that it encourages among people who do interact, and antisocial in its it drives us away from the only kind of real human interactions that can nurture us, face-to-face, person-to-person, real human relationships in real time. This also, by the way, goes, and not for today's discussion probably, but this has to be part of the country we're imagining. And I just think that, you know, that we wake up on Wednesday and we realize, you know, that what people on both sides of this question say is true, that the Trump phenomenon is not going away anytime soon, no. that it does bespeak all these deeper problems with us as a country, that the solution of which is not clear. And at the same time, though, that it's like the Thornton Wilder play By the Skin of Our Teeth, you know, in which in three acts, humanity just barely survives each time, needing an enormous amount of luck and coincidence and a little bit, but some basic courage and decency. The lead character there in that play is called Henry Antrobus. Henry wakes up the day after this election, if things go well, the same way he woke up the day after the glaciers receded. We can begin to put this thing back together. So much depends on progressives. And just going from here, I want to go back to something we talked about last week, and that is, you know, I said that there's no need, if we win the Senate by a couple of votes, there is no need to be bipartisan with Mitch McConnell. It's a mistake. The word ought to be expunged. When most people say bipartisan, all they mean is open-minded, civil, and respectful. And we should be that every day. Right. We should take as little of the bait from the other side as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. But we shouldn't interact with them. And that leaves us with a special responsibility. That means that Democrats have to get bipartisan with themselves, because the entire debate is going to be intramural. Within, the only debate worth having is not whether or not climate change exists, but what to do about it.
Right.
Not even whether to act immediately and with great resources, but how to deploy them. What's the best way to do all that? And you can go through a whole set of issues, and you quickly realize that for us to save ourselves, you know, whether the issue is climate change or the middle class, prosperity and security of the middle class, or the corruption and degradation of our democracy, that the whole debate is for the country. And by the way, as reflected in polls, 60 to 70% of the country is where we are on this. Okay. They agree on all these things. And so the question for us is how to have that debate.
Right. Let me just stop you here. Can I just say, the country agrees with us. Then the problem is for us is delivering on what they agree with us on. It is the delivery. It's not the discussion. It's the damn delivery. I don't care about bipartisanship. People don't live in a partisan world. They live in the world. You know, when you lose your job, they don't ask you whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. When you get COVID, they don't ask you if you're a Republican or a Democrat. When your kid goes to college, they don't ask you if you're a Republican or a Democrat. When you get stopped on the street by a cop, they don't ask that question. I think the idea that 60% of the American people agree with us is lovely. What is the burden on us is to deliver on it. And just to say it, and we've been saying it for years, that's my problem. If there's a sense of disappointment, it is with my party that has failed to actually act when they had the power. And if, God help us, we do control the Senate, we do control the White House, we do control the House, then the most important thing to do is for us to act. And Bill, I'll be honest with you, it may not be the perfect act, but it better be action that people can feel, see, and hear. You know what was so powerful about that $600 stimulus per week for the unemployment check? Is that people had never seen that kind of money, some people. Never, ever, ever. And they acted. They acted when people needed it. They acted when people were unemployed. And it calmed people down until they could get to the next point. That is the message that we must act on, is that words have no meaning. Actions are everything. I'm going to sort of test my party by, because I've heard the words before. I've never seen them deliver.
Well, and parenthetically, Mitch McConnell thought that the $600 a week would make them all dependent and dispirited. When in fact, what I think it did was it did for millions of people. The Republicans are right. They hadn't had this much disposable income in a while. What those people got a little taste of what life ought to be like.
Exactly.
I think that's the real dangerous thing for Republicans, is not the lazy proletariat they've been arguing against since the party was formed, but it's that people will have a sense of what they've been missing out on. And that will make them, I think, more productive in the workplace, but also more demanding as citizens of their government. I do want to go back to this one thing, though, and one is about how progressives approach this. And the first thing I want to say is, again, as I said last week, this is the most progressive party platform ever adopted. If we got it, it would include almost everything that we were dreaming of as of 4 years ago. It would recoup all the lost purchasing power of the minimum wage and then some. It would finally extend healthcare to everyone if the public option were done right. We should frame this, number one, right around what the central question has always been about this platform, which is, do you really mean it? And will you keep your word?
Right.
Progressives should not be in a fight over will you go further. They should be in a fight about will you keep your word. Within that, there can be some artful tweaking. Again, will you keep your word above all means don't walk on your corruption commitments like both Obama and Trump did.
Right.
Okay. Neither side has kept its word on that, and the public overwhelmingly desires it. And can you fix the healthcare system so that it does begin to relieve us of the burden of the for-profit insurance industry? But basically, it's about will you keep your word. With the discussion with the establishment ought to be, will you keep your word? And then the discussion with the public has to include an understanding of reasonable people's fears that too much money will be spent on things people haven't thought enough about in advance. That we really are the reinventing government stuff that Al Gore did in the Clinton administration was all good. Can you make the government a little bit leaner, a little bit more responsive, a little fairer, a lot less corrupt? Can we make a government that daily does its job and once in a while even makes us proud? Of course we can. Of course we can. And then we have to really work, lastly, and the thing that's been avoided throughout this race, it was symbolic of our entire political debate that the foreign policy debate got canceled in the presidential race. Because it's the part that always, you know, almost always just slips out of the discussion. In part, it's because progressives in the beginning in the 1950s were always being some form of red baited or called weak or foolish or naive, when in fact, the great, great foolishness was the foolishness of our foreign policy and national security establishment. These were not God's gifts to world peace. They did some good things, but their fundamental premises need to be re-examined. And this is the moment for that too. And Trump, again, has given us an inadvertent, unintended gift in that his isolationism has made it possible to question military interventionism all around the world.
Right.
There's no longer someone waiting to say you're horrible if you say maybe we should stop shooting strangers in places we've only visited as tourists, you know, in order to have our way. Maybe it's time to strengthen and fix the United Nations. Maybe it's time for multilateral conflict resolution. Maybe it's time for America to sign on to the rule of law. I would favor I'm not where Glenn Greenwald, all these people are. I can't stand Putin, not because I'm not a cold warrior. Not because I don't fear his tanks. I fear his banks. I fear his assault, not on America, but on democracy itself. Exactly. I want to, there are lots of things I want to do, but at the same time, I want people to realize that it's not going to be a battle America wins against that foe. It's going to be a battle we all win to establish a whole different framework. And so, for instance, coming out of this election, I would love to see strong sanctions against Russia. I would love to see strong sanctions against any country that interfered. And then I would love to see a complete, honest public disclosure of all the elections we've meddled in when we caused all these decades of trouble with Iran by running a coup against their democratically elected president back in the 1950s. You can go country by country and see the things that we did, not to bash America, of course not, to understand ourselves, to know everything we did, the good and the bad alike, so we can fix it, just like you do in every other relationship.
So
there's a lot here that needs to be done in terms of the beginning of foreign policy reform is the recognition that America needs to get out of the business of military interventionism and into the business of multilateral institution building. And then needs to make its foreign policy transparent above all. And one last practical note, our basic MO across the world has been to corrupt the nations we wish to influence. We go in constantly and we buy elites. We didn't understand free trade. Free globalization, the uber free trade of globalization meant predatory corporations scouring the globe for low wages and weak governments. That's what free trade meant, and nobody here could see it, had the eyes to see it. We need to know what kinds of alternatives we want structurally, but also we need to just say this. Our government, we have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It forbids corporations from going in and bribing countries. Here's a simple idea. The federal government of the United States should live by the same laws it enacted for all of those companies doing business in all of those countries. We should finally live up to our own ideals abroad. It'll do nothing but good if we do that, even on a material basis for us in the longer term.
You talked about corruption. People keep saying, oh, I don't want to go back. And I'm going, no. Actions need to have consequences. If you don't address the corruption in government, if you don't address the corporate corruption, what are people angry about? They're angry about the fact that nobody, not one banker, did the perp walk after the 2008 economic meltdown. They're still angry. They saw no consequences for what they did to their lives, what they did to their communities, for what they did for their home ownership. They're looking for accountability. It is not about retribution. It is about actions having consequences. It's what you do with your children. It's what you do with your children. How can you ask government to turn a blind eye to that and then think that you can improve the system without addressing the failure? That means you've baked the failure in, Bill. That's what you've done. You haven't addressed it. You haven't cut it out. You have allowed it to coexist. And if it coexists, it comes back and it eats you alive. And that's why I want them to address the corruption and then to move forward on fixing a system that is so, it's, you know what's so exciting? There's so much to do and there's so many places to look that as you begin to fix things, people are worried about the Trump base. I am not worried about them. You know why? Because if they get healthcare, they're less angry. If they get a $15 to $20, you know, an hour wage, they're less angry. If they get overtime, they have less time to grab their gun and be, you know, bitching and moaning about something. So in a lot of ways, you are addressing the Trump base as you are fixing and healing the economy, because what is feeding them is the fact that they're living less long. What is feeding them is that they've lost the job that used to pay them $25 an hour, and now they're trying to live on $11 an hour. What's feeding them? All their anger is pointed at the wrong direction. They pointed it at the immigrant. They pointed it at the minority. They pointed it at someone that doesn't look like them. Why don't we fix it? And then they're suddenly going to go, wait a minute, you mean it wasn't that black guy? Wait a minute, you mean it wasn't that immigrant? It then sort of sucks the anger and the sort of the pointing of blame out of them, because how could they have something and those immigrants are still here? How is that even possible?
One of the things that the Trump people did to their detriment, I think, was set such a low bar for Joe Biden in the debate. As long as he didn't come out wearing a bib and drooling on it, he was going to score at least a close win. In a way, they've done that the same thing for the Biden administration.
Exactly. Okay?
I will wait till about April to turn to some Trumpist and say, so how does it feel living in Caracas? You enjoying this? You think they're ever going to be able to put those fires out in the cities? You know, the fact of the matter is that the moment the race baiting Trump is gone, the temperature goes down.
Exactly.
It goes down. It's already happening in cities. The very fact that he's gone makes things better, more peaceful. So there are lots of things that happen of their own. And then we have to figure out what it is we need to make happen. And I agree with you about corruption. I would also just say that, you know, for a long time, I've been in favor of what the right calls court packing, mostly because the right's been doing it for so long. And that with two presidents I believe were illegitimately elected, George Bush and Donald Trump, they packed the court with not just conservatives, not just Republicans, but extreme Republicans and extreme conservatives and people who, as you saw on Brett Kavanaugh's odious opinion this week on the ballots cases, is nothing but a glorified political apparatchik, a partisan. I mean, corrupt. That is a form of corruption. And so I hope we really dedicate ourselves to keeping our words on corruption. And I hope we enlarge the judiciary. You enlarge the judiciary, and a year later, Citizens United is gone.
So you know what I want to call it?
We'll do to Citizens United what they want to do to Roe v. Wade. Okay.
So I don't want to call it enlarging the judiciary. I want to talk about expanding justice. I don't want to call it enlarging the judiciary. I want people to say, I want more justice, not justice in a robe, but justice. It turns out that by enlarging the court, you're bringing about more justice. So in a lot of ways, you're going to say to people, what are you upset about? The fact that there are more people that are able to sort of settle cases that are going to bring about a just result. You don't want that? You don't want greater access to justice? That's what we are doing. We are providing an avenue for that. The Republicans don't like voters. They don't want someone to sort of tell them what to do, even though technically the voters are the ones that are supposed to hire them. Well, guess what? They want them fired. They don't want more justice. Why? Because it might bring more fairness to the system. So what we have to do is reframe the vote and reframe justice. It's not about a robe. It's about justice. And that's not necessarily the same thing.
I agree with that. We also have to give people specific examples, which Democrats always forget to do.
Yes, exactly.
This is a question about whether we're going to have Roe v. Wade. I regret the Coney Barrett hearings and collateral debate because I don't think it should have been just about health care. There are lots of things here. The Supreme Court has said you don't have the right or even the reason to curb corruption in campaign finances. All right. And we can't live with that any longer. That's the only way to drain the swamp.
Exactly.
So you want to protect Roe v. Wade? You want to drain the swamp? It's not clear we can have even the common sense gun laws that 70 to 90% of the American people agree on and desperately want. And so we just can't let that sit there. We have to be forthright, just reminding people, here are the stakes, and also reminding them what the other side did.
Exactly. Remind them what the other side did. And the next time we talk, Bill Curry, it'll be after the November 3rd election. I'm dreaming about that conversation. So
let me just say, if it doesn't go well, I'll be right here at my home rocking back and forth in the fetal position.
You might want to keep
the questions to true, false, and multiple choice.
All right. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you so much, Bill Curry, for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
I think I look forward to next Friday's conversation. Ciao.
Amen.
All right.